What is up?
Yellow.
We hope everyone's week is off to a great start. And if you happen to live on the East Coast, we hope everyone enjoyed all the snow that decided to come through last week and bless us.
Some more than others got quite a few inches.
But this week is episode 3 of our true crime series, Killer Couples Edition. And if you haven't listened to last week's insane episode, definitely pause this episode right now and go do that and then come back to this one. But let's not waste any more time. Grab yourself a drink, a snack, and let's get into it.
All right, before we dive into the cases, I'm going to give you guys the trigger warning. This episode deals with violent, gruesome, and triggering events, including sexual assault, animal abuse, murder, and more, that may not be suitable for all listeners. The information for this podcast episode is based off extensive research done by both of us. We at Cosign Podcast do not intend any disrespect to the victims or their family members involved in these crimes. Listener discretion is advised.
So today, I am going to be telling you guys about Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Elwood Tool. So Henry Lee Lucas was born in Blacksburg, Virginia in 1936. His father, Anderson No Legs Lucas, had lost his legs in a workplace accident by a railroad, forcing him to make a living by manufacturing alcohol illegally, aka moonshine, and he was also an alcoholic. He introduced Henry to alcohol at a young age. Henry's mother, Viola Dixon Lucas, was a prostitute as well as an alcoholic and ruled the household, which was a one-room log cabin. Henry was the youngest of their 9 children and often suffered from his mother's rage, as would his father and brother. So just imagine, 2 alcoholic parents, 1 handicapped, and 9 children in a 1-bedroom log cabin.
That's why she's mad.
Right.
All the time.
All the time. When Henry was 8 years old, he was beaten by her on the head with a wooden plank so hard that he spent 3 days in a coma. She would also make him watch her have sex with her lover, Uncle Bernie, along with a number of other strange men, and forced Henry to dress up in girls' clothing. She also shot and killed a mule Henry was given by an uncle and abused him for accepting a teddy bear at school. When he was 10 years old, he suffered an accidental injury to his left eye during a fight with his brother. The injury was ignored by his mother for days until it was infected so badly that the eye had to be removed and replaced with a glass eye when Henry was only 11 years old. By that age, he was already almost an alcoholic as well. His older half-brother and Uncle Bernie had also introduced him to bestiality, which we talked in a previous episode, which is sex with animals, and animal torture. In 1949, his dad passed away from hypothermia after passing out drunk in a blizzard. At this time, Henry was around 14 or 15 and said he had his first human sexual experience abducting an unknown teenage girl from a bus stop, beating her unconscious, and then raping her and strangling her to death. Some sources name this victim as 17-year-old Laura Burnley, who disappeared in March of 1951, but this has never been confirmed. The next year, Lucas received his first prison sentence when he and 2 of his half-brothers were arrested for burglary. He spent a year at a school for juvenile delinquents in Beaumont, which with its electricity and running water was luxurious compared to the cabin he lived in with his family. In June 1954, he was sentenced to 6 years incarceration for a dozen counts of burglary and was released on September 2, 1959 after 2 failed escape attempts. He moved to his sister's place in Michigan, but his mom soon caught up with him. When she wanted him to come back to take care of her, they got into an argument that resulted in her death when he stabbed her in the neck, causing her to have a fatal heart attack. Imagine everything that his mom did to him, and then coming and demanding you take care of her.
Right. Yeah, I'd probably stab her in the neck too.
Right. So even though he claimed self-defense, he was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to 20 to 40 years in prison. After being released due to prison overcrowding in June 1970, after serving only 10 years of his sentence, Henry was sentenced to another 3.5 years in prison for trying to kidnap 3 young girls. After being released, he went to Pennsylvania, where he worked at a mushroom farm and got married to Betty Crawford, the widow of a cousin of his, in 1975, but he left her when she accused him of molesting her 2 daughters. At this point, he started drifting around, supporting himself through various odd jobs, and, by his own account, began what became a long series of murders, traveling along highways and raping and murdering women. So now we're going to go to Otis. So Otis Elwood Toole was born in Jacksonville, Florida in 1947 and came from a background similar to that of Henry. His mother was an abusive religious fanatic. He claimed that he had been sexually abused by his own family after coming out as gay at a young age. Otis was assaulted by almost every person he thought he could trust growing up. His mother dressed him up as a girl, his older sister raped him before he was 10 years old, and his father prostituted him to a neighbor when he was only 5. When he was only 14 years old, Otis killed someone for the very first time. After a traveling salesman tried to pick him up for sex, Otis ended up running him over with his car. He also claimed that his grandmother had been a Satanist who had taught him self-mutilation and grave robbing. I mean, these kids just have no chance, really.
So his mother's an abusive religious fanatic and his grandmother is allegedly a Satanist. So it's like all spectrum, like
yeah,
both sides of the spectrum mm-hmm. he's getting this from.
Otis had an estimated IQ of only 75 and was also diagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. He frequently ran away and was a serial arsonist at a young age. It is uncertain how he got around between 1966 and 1973, but it's believed he made a living through panhandling and prostitution. He was a prime murder suspect on different occasions, but he was never arrested. And that's literally all there is about him. There's a lot more on Henry Lucas, and I'll explain why I think that is later, but that's all that there is on his childhood. So I'm going to tell you how they actually met and became a couple. So Henry Lucas and Otis Toole met in 1976 at a soup kitchen. Both of them had been raised by abusive mothers who had forced their sons to dress like girls. Both had suffered sexual trauma before the age of 10, and by the time they met, both of them were already murderers. Drawn together by their shared childhood trauma, Henry and Otis quickly fell in love with each other, and when they realized that they both enjoyed killing, they soon went on a cross-country killing spree. Henry and Otis traveled across 26 states in the 1970s, killing wherever they went. They preyed upon anyone they could find, including hitchhikers, sex workers, and migrants. For them, killing was just a way for the couple to bond. They talked about it openly, comparing notes and giving each other tips. Henry later claimed that he coached Otis on how to get away with murder. He was doing all his crimes all one way, Henry said. I started to correct him in his ways in doing the crime where he wouldn't leave information. Henry and Otis didn't just kill. They would also rape and torture their victims before murdering them. After their victims were dead, the couple would mutilate the bodies. Henry later said that they didn't feel the slightest amount of guilt for their actions. He even joked that he once crossed 2 state lines with someone's severed head in the back seat. As if that weren't enough, the killer couple also dabbled in cannibalism. Years after their arrest, they were caught discussing cannibalism over a prison phone. Otis sounded almost nostalgic, saying, "Remember how I like to pour some blood out of them? Some taste like real meat when it's got barbecue sauce on it." End quote. It literally makes me nauseous.
Ew.
So while it might seem like these two terrifying men were made for each other, their relationship actually fell apart when Henry became interested in Otis's teenage niece, Becky Powell. Henry later said that he liked having someone look up to him, so he ran off with her and left Otis. Otis was so upset that he allegedly killed 9 people just to blow off steam. But Henry and Becky didn't make it very far. While they apparently settled down on a ranch in Ringgold, Texas, the two soon got into a heated argument. In response, Henry lured Becky into an isolated field. He then killed her, dismembered her body, and scattered the remains. Then, Henry lured the woman who owned the ranch out to the same field, killed her, and stuffed her body into a drainage pipe. Soon afterward, Henry was arrested in Texas in 1983. Meanwhile, Otis was separately in prison in Florida in 1984 for burning a 64-year-old man alive. After all this time, the killer couple was finally behind bars, but the mystery behind their murder spree had just begun. Surprisingly, Henry Lucas wasn't arrested for murder, but for possession of a deadly weapon. Once he was in custody, he began to talk about his murders to any police officer who would listen. In fact, the law enforcement officers from all over the country had contacted the Texas Rangers to schedule interviews with Henry for open cases that they had themselves. The Ranger in the Netflix documentary said they had over 1,000 police officers sign up for interviews and a backlog of over 2 months worth of background back-to-back interview scheduled just to talk to Henry. As for Otis Toole, he was far more reluctant to talk about his crimes at first, but once he learned that Lucas was taking cops on guided tours of their murder sites, Otis soon began backing up his former lover's claims. By his count, they murdered 108 people, including 6-year-old Adam Walsh, the son of future America's Most Wanted host, John Walsh. For those who don't know, the company me and Mackenzie used to work for, when we hired people, we were required to show a video called Code Adam, and it was about this case. And it's a really old video, and I know tons of companies use it, so if you've ever worked in retail, you've probably seen it.
Yep.
So Otis insisted that he was the young boy's murderer. He even argued with the police when they doubted his claims. He told them, oh no, I killed him too. There's no doubt about that. According to Otis, he had taken Adam from a Sears parking lot in 1981. After decapitating the young boy with a machete, Otis drove around with the head in his car for so long that he forgot it was there. When he later happened upon it, he simply just tossed it into a canal.
Casual.
Yeah. 6-year-old boy.
It's like they're fighting for the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a whole popularity stunt to them, it seems like, anyway.
Adam Walsh was one of the most well-known victims killed by Henry and Otis. Since his murder ended up resulting in new child protection laws and his father getting into television and criminal justice. Meanwhile, Henry openly confessed to more than 600 murders, but he had his own motivations for doing so. I made the police look stupid, he later boasted. I was out to wreck Texas law enforcement. He also later admitted that confessing to crimes won him extra privileges. The police would often drive him out to the scene of the crime and even let him get fast food on the way. For a man who had already been sentenced to death row, confessing to murder upon murder was just a way to spend some time outside. So the truth of the murders. For a long time, police took Henry and Otis at their word. Henry's confessions were so plentiful that they led the Texas Rangers to establish a Henry Lee Lucas task force assigned to oversee his crimes. In turn, Henry offered the Rangers grisly details of every single murder he confessed to. He even drew detailed pictures of his alleged victims, much like prolific serial killer Samuel Little. Eerily, Henry's pictures were so precise that they even included eye color. But then his confessions began to slowly unravel. As time went on, law enforcement began to pick up on some major discrepancies in Henry's timelines. Plus, DNA testing began to contradict some of his stories. On top of that, he didn't offer much hard evidence to back up his increasingly far-fetched stories. It was later revealed that some members of the task force assigned to him secretly provided him with evidence and asked him leading questions in an attempt to get more confessions. With that said, some Texas Rangers remained convinced that he was telling the truth about at least some of the murders. I remember him trying to cop to one he didn't do, said retired Texas Ranger Glenn Elliott. But there was another murder case where I'll kiss your butt if he didn't lead us right to the deer stand where the murder took place. Ain't no way he could have guessed that, and I damn sure didn't tell him. End quote. Henry himself admitted to exaggerating and making up stories. I only got 3 murders, he claimed. But they're going wild every time I tell them about some more. Talking about the investigators. Given Henry's habit of lying, it's impossible to know what his real body count was. The same goes for Otis Toole. The 2019 Netflix docuseries called The Confession Killer tried to get a little closer to the truth, but to this day, no one is exactly sure how many people Henry and Otis Toole actually killed. So there's no way to know how much of their story is true. A district attorney named Ken Anderson, who prosecuted Henry, said he believed the murderer had killed anywhere from 3 to 12 people. I don't think he knew exactly, Anderson said. It's difficult to imagine you can rely on anything he said, but the fact remains he was a serial killer, even though we're unable to pinpoint the exact number. Otis Toole died of liver failure in prison in 1996. Henry died of heart failure in prison in 2001, taking the truth about their crimes with him to the grave. Even though Henry died in prison, he had previously been pardoned from death row and had been sentenced to life in prison. To this day, many people are still trying to get to the bottom of this twisted, bizarre story. Other than the Confession Killer docuseries, 2 other documentaries and 4 films have been made about this case, including the critically acclaimed Henry: Portrait of a Serial Killer. The real number of murders may never be known, and tragically, the potentially false confessions from the killers have had horrifying consequences for the families of the murder victims. They went from feeling a sense of closure that these killers were behind bars to questioning whether those men had even killed their loved loved ones in the first place. In the worst case scenario, the real killers behind some of the fake confessions might still be out there. It's not hard to wonder why some families have been lobbying to get the cases reopened. Not only did Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole murder people, but they also left a scar of uncertainty that the families of murder victims feel to this day. And that may be one of the worst parts of their legacy. So true to form, I've got a few Criminal Minds references for you. So season one, Extreme Aggressor, which is literally the first episode of the first season of the entire series. Henry's first mention was in the pilot episode. In it, Hotch is discussing with Gideon possible names for his soon-to-be born son. His wife having picked the name Henry, Hotch is troubled by the fact that it is the same as a serial killer's. Gideon completes it by adding Lee Lucas. Season four, the episode Conflicted, while not directly mentioned or referenced, Henry appears to have been an inspiration for the episode's unsub Adam Jackson. Both were serial killers who grew up with one deceased parent and one abusive parent, an abuse which involved both beatings and cross-dressing. Both targeted the opposite gender in some way, had some sexual element in their crimes, and both attempted to kill their abusive parent with a knife. Coincidentally, two of Henry's alleged victims, Estella Montoya and Catherine Robinson, were killed in Corpus Christi, Texas, the town the main suspect, Adam Jackson, was from the show. Season 5, The Longest Night, while not directly mentioned or referenced in the season finale, Henry appears to have been an inspiration for its unsub Billy Flynn. Both were prolific serial killers, rapists, and one-time cop killers with prostitute mothers who forced them as children to watch as they had sex with multiple men. Both killed their mothers and were incarcerated for it and later began killing after their release, killing hundreds of victims. They both had a sexual element in their crimes, used revolvers, tied up and killed a cop with a revolver, were given nicknames for their crimes, and both attempted to abduct at least one young girl. Season 7, Profiling 101, Henry was the confirmed inspiration for Thomas Yates. Both were prolific serial killers who grew up with at least one abusive relative with both physical torture and cross-dressing. Both committed their first crimes when they were young, killed over 100 victims, were given nicknames for their crimes, mutilated their victims post-mortem, and both gave numerous confessions after they were apprehended. And then the last one is season 8, which he's not confirmed for this one, but out of all of the episodes, I think this one reminded me of the case the most, and it was The Silencer. And while not directly mentioned or referenced, Henry appears to have been an inspiration for the episode's unsub John Myers. So both were serial killers and one-time cop killers who were raised by abusive mothers. Both of their mothers became their first victims. They both had damaged left eyes, were active in Texas, and were given nicknames for their crime. So there's your Criminal Minds references. If you do watch the documentary, it is mostly about Henry Lucas. When people talk about Henry Lucas, most people don't talk about Otis Toole. I don't know why. And I think maybe it's because Otis was caught a year later and he had already been confessing for over a year. Right. So he kind of got all the attention for all their crimes.
Right.
And like you said, it looked like they were competing with each other.
That's what it looked like to me. And to reference their childhood, I don't in any way feel sorry for these men, but it does make you wonder. They didn't have a chance,
yeah,
like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of makes you think about the way someone is brought up, what they're born into, and clearly what they could potentially become.
It makes you wonder who they would have been if their childhood would have been different.
Right, had they been given dealt different card.
We're back. Okay, wow. To that case. It's not going to get any better from here, though, guys. It's not going to get any better. And I would like to preface this case by telling you why it's called the Moores Murderers. All of the victims in this case were buried or found at Saddleworth Moor, which is a moorland in northwest England. Saddleworth Moor reaches more than 1,312 feet above sea level, and it's in the Dark Peak area of the Peak District National Park. So that's the primary location for a lot of where these bodies were found. So if you couldn't guess already, I'm going to be telling you guys about the Moores murders. Let's start with Ian Brady. Ian Brady was born in Scotland as Ian Duncan Stewart on January 2nd, 1938. His mom was Margaret Peggy Stewart, an unmarried tea room waitress. The identity of Brady's father has never been reliably certain, although his mother said that he was a reporter working for a Glasgow newspaper who died 3 months before Brady was even born. Ian's mother had very little support, and after a few months was forced to give her son into the care of Mary and John Sloan, a local couple with 4 children of their own. Ian took their family name and became known as Ian Sloan. His mother continued to visit him throughout his childhood, though. Various authors have stated that he tortured animals, although he objected to such accusations. At the age of 9 years old, Ian visited Loch Lomond with his family, where he reportedly discovered an affinity for the outdoors. And a few months later, the family moved to a new house, and Ian was accepted for Shawlands Academy, which is a school for above-average pupils. He left the academy at age 15 and took a job as a tea boy at a shipyard. 9 months later, he began working as a butcher's messenger boy. Ian had a girlfriend named Evelyn Grant, but their relationship ended when he threatened her with a knife after she visited a dance with another boy. He again appeared before the court, this time with 9 charges against him, and shortly before his 17th birthday, he was placed on probation on condition that he went back to live with his mother. Brady's mother had moved to Manchester and married an Irish merchant named Patrick Brady, who got Ian a job as a fruit porter, and then Ian ended up taking Patrick's last name, becoming Ian Brady. Within a year of moving to Manchester, Ian was caught with a sack full of lead seals he had stolen and was trying to smuggle out of the market. He was sent to prison for 3 months. Since he was still under the age of 18, Ian was sentenced to 2 years of training at a custodial institution for youthful offenders. After being discovered drunk on alcohol that he had brewed himself, he was moved to a much tougher unit. When Ian was released on November 14, 1957, he returned to Manchester, where he took a laboring job that he absolutely hated. In January 1959, Ian applied for and was offered a clerical job at a chemical distribution company. His colleagues described him as a quiet, punctual, but short-tempered young man. Ian read books, including Teach Yourself German, as well as works on Nazi atrocities, and he also had a Tiger Club motorcycle. Let's skip to Myra Henley. Myra Henley was born in a suburb of Manchester on July 23rd, 1942, to parents Nellie and Bob Henley. Her father was an alcoholic who beat her regularly when she was a young child. Their family house was in very poor condition, and Myra was forced to sleep in a single bed next to her parents' double bed. Their living situation deteriorated further when Myra's sister Maureen was born in August of 1946. And a year later, when Myra was only 5, she was sent to live with her grandmother.
All these kids!
I know. Don't be having kids if you can't take care of them. Myra's father had served with the Parachute Division, which is an airborne infantry of the British Army, and he was stationed in North Africa during the Second World War. When Myra was 8, a local boy scratched her cheeks, which it drew blood. She burst into tears and ran to her father, who threatened to leather her, which is beat, basically, if she did not retaliate against the young boy. Myra found that boy and knocked him down with a series of punches. Go, girl. Malcolm McCulloch, a professor of forensic psychiatry at Cardiff University, has written that Myra's relationship with her father is what brutalized her. She was not only used to violence in the home, but was rewarded for it outside of the home. When this happens at such a young age, it can distort a person's reaction to such situations for life. In June 1957, one of Myra's closest friends, 13-year-old Michael Higgins, invited her to go swimming with friends at a local disused reservoir. But she went out with another friend instead, and Michael Higgins ended up drowning that same day. And Myra, who was a good swimmer, was deeply upset and blamed herself because she was not with him. I know. His funeral was held at St. Francis Monastery, which is where Myra was baptized as a Catholic in 1942. Myra was increasingly drawn to the Roman Catholic Church after this. At age 17, she became engaged after a very short courtship, but called it off several months later after deciding the young man was immature and unable to provide her with the life that she wanted. Myra also took weekly judo lessons at a local school, but found partners reluctant to train with her because she was often slow to release her grip. She was later released from her job at the engineering company for absenteeism after 6 months. In January 1961, 18-year-old Myra joined that same chemical distribution company that Ian was already working at as a typist. She soon became infatuated with Ian, despite learning that he had a criminal record. Myra began a diary, and although she had dates with other men, some of these entries detailed her fascination with Ian, who she eventually spoke to for the first time on July 27th, 1961.
I'm sorry, that just makes me think, July 7th, he spoke to me.
Right. October 3rd, he asked me what day it was. Yeah. It's October 3rd. Over the next few months, she continued to make entries but grew increasingly disillusioned with him until December 22nd when Ian finally asked her on a date to the movies. She also detailed that after the first date, Ian gave her reading material and that they would spend their lunch breaks reading aloud to one another about the Nazi atrocities. Myra began to emulate an ideal of Aryan perfection, bleaching her hair blonde and applying thick crimson lipstick. She expressed concern at some aspects of Ian's character in a letter to a childhood friend mentioning an incident where she had been drugged by him, but also wrote of her obsession with him. Then a few months later, she asked her friend to destroy the letter. Myra began to change her appearance even further, wearing clothing considered risque at the time, such as high boots, short skirts, and leather jackets, and the two became less sociable with their colleagues. The couple were regulars at the library, borrowing books on philosophy as well as crime and torture. They also read works by the Marquis de Sade and a book called Crime and Punishment. Although Myra was not a qualified driver, she had passed her test on November 7, 1963 after failing three times. She often hired a van in which the couple planned bank robberies. At some point, Myra befriended George Clitheroe, the president of a rifle club, and on several occasions would visit shooting ranges. Although George was puzzled by her interest, he did arrange for her to buy a .22 rifle from a gun merchant in Manchester. She did somehow manage to purchase a Webley 45 and a Smith & Wesson 38 from other members of the club, though.
I don't like where this is going.
Ian already owned what you would call a box brownie, which is what he used to take photographs of Myra and her dog Puppet, but then he upgraded to a more sophisticated model and also purchased lights and darkroom equipment. The pair took explicit photographs of each other, and for Myra, this demonstrated a marked change from her earlier, more shy nature. Myra claimed that Ian began to talk about committing the perfect murder, and he often spoke to her about Meyer Levin's published novel called Compulsion, the story that tells a fictionalized account of two young men from well-to-do families who attempt to commit the perfect murder of a 12-year-old boy and who escape the death penalty because of their age. So let's get into the murders and their victims. On July 12, 1963, Ian told Myra that he wanted to commit the perfect murder. After work, he instructed her to drive a borrowed van around while he followed on his motorcycle. When he spotted a likely victim, he would flash his headlight to Myra. As he was driving, Ian saw a young girl and signaled to Myra, who did not stop because she recognized the girl as 8-year-old neighbor of her mother. Sometime after 7:30 p.m., Ian signaled Myra again to stop for 16-year-old Pauline Reed, a schoolmate of her sister. Pauline was on her way to a dance class, and Myra stopped and offered her a ride. Once Pauline was in the van, Myra asked her to help search Saddleworth Moor for an expensive lost glove. When Ian arrived on his motorcycle, Myra told Pauline that he would be helping them look for this glove. But Myra later claimed that she waited in the van while Ian was the one who took Pauline onto the moor. Ian returned after about 30 minutes and took Myra to the spot where Pauline laid dying. Pauline's clothes were in disarray and she had been nearly decapitated by two cuts to the throat, including a 4-inch incision across her voice box, inflicted with considerable force and into which the collar of her coat and throat chain had been pushed. When Myra asked Ian whether he raped Pauline, she said that he replied, "Of course I did." Myra stayed with Pauline's body while Ian retrieved a shovel that he had hidden nearby on a previous visit, then returned to the van while Ian buried Pauline's body. When Ian was asked to recount this attack, he said that Myra was not only present for it, but participated in the sexual assault. In the early evening of November 23, 1963, at a market in Ashton, Ian and Myra offered 12-year-old John Kilbride a ride home, saying his parents might worry that he was out so late. They also promised him a bottle of wine. Once John was inside the car, Ian said that they would have to make a detour to their home for the wine, and as they were en route, he suggested another detour, this time to search for a glove that Myra had lost on the moor. When they reached Saddleworth, Ian took John with him while Myra waited in the car. Ian sexually assaulted John and tried to slit his throat with a 6-inch serrated blade before strangling him with a shoelace. A huge search was done to find John 8 days after he failed to return home.
8 days?
8 days. 2,000 volunteers scoured waste grounds and rundown buildings with over 700 statements taken and 500 missing posters printed. In the time between November 1963 and June 1964, Myra bought a used vehicle but then soon traded it for a minivan. Early in the evening of June 16th, 1964, Myra asked 12-year-old Keith Bennett, who was on his way to his grandmother's house, for help in loading some boxes into her car and then offered to drive him home. Ian was in the back of the van as Myra drove to a nearby rest area on Saddleworth Moor. When they parked, Ian apparently went off with Keith, supposedly looking for that lost glove yet again, and after about 30 minutes, Brady returned along, carrying that same shovel he had hidden earlier, and in response to Myra's questions, Ian said that he had sexually assaulted Keith and strangled him with a piece of string. Keith's stepfather, Jimmy Johnson, was originally the main suspect, and in the 2 years following Keith's disappearance, Jimmy was taken in for questioning on 4 different occasions. Detectives searched under the floorboards of Jimmy's house, and because his house was in a row with others that were connected, extended search was done on the entire street, but nothing was found. So remember that I told you that Myra had a sister named Maureen? Well, Maureen married David Smith on August 15th, 1964. The marriage was urgently arranged and performed at their local register's office, which is basically a courthouse back in the day. None of Maureen's relatives attended the wedding. Her family did not approve of David because he had several criminal convictions, including actual bodily harm and breaking into houses, the first of which wounding with intent that occurred when he was 11 years old. Myra did not approve of the marriage, and her mother was too embarrassed as Maureen was 7 months pregnant. The newlyweds moved into David's father's house. The next day, Ian suggested that the 4 of them take a trip to Windermere, which is the largest natural lake in England. This was the first time that Ian and David had officially met, and this is going to be important. And Ian was apparently very impressed by David's demeanor. The two would talk about society, the distribution of wealth, and the possibility of robbing a bank. David was younger than Ian and was similarly impressed by him, who throughout the day had paid for his food and his wine. The trip to the lake was the first of many outings that the two would share, and allegedly this made Myra very jealous of their friendship, so she became closer to her sister because of it. In 1964, Myra, her grandmother, and Ian were all rehoused as a part of a post-war slum clearance in Manchester. They moved to 16 Wardlebrook Avenue in the new Overspill estate of Cheshire. Ian and Myra became friendly with Patricia Hodges, an 11-year-old who lived at 12 Wardlebrook Avenue. Patricia accompanied the two on their trips to Saddleworth Moor to collect peat, which is decayed vegetation. That's something that many of the householders that were being rehoused would use to improve the soil because it wasn't that great. The couple, however, never harmed Patricia. Since she lived a few doors down, this would make it too easy, I guess, for police to solve the disappearance. On Boxing Day, 1964, Myra left her grandmother at a relative's house and refused to allow her back in the house for that day. The same day, Ian and Myra visited a fair and noticed 10-year-old Leslie Ann Downey. They approached her and deliberately dropped some of their shopping bags they were carrying and then asked her for help in taking the packages to their car and then to their house. At the house, Leslie was undressed, gagged, and forced to pose for photographs before being raped and killed, perhaps strangled with a piece of string, since that seemed to be Ian's MO. Myra later maintained that she went to fill a bath for Leslie and found her dead when she returned, but Ian claimed that Myra is the one who killed Leslie. The following morning, Ian and Myra drove Leslie's body to Saddleworth Moor and buried her, naked, with her clothes at her feet, in a very shallow grave. That same day, Myra told her grandmother that she could come back home. By February 1965, David had become a regular visitor of Ian's. Ian gave David books to read, and the two discussed robbery and murder, as we know. And on Myra's 23rd birthday, her sister and brother-in-law, who had until then been living with relatives, were rehoused to the same street that Ian and Myra were on. The two couples began to see each other even more so, but usually only on Ian's terms. On the evening of October 6th, 1965, Myra drove Ian to Manchester Central train station, where she waited outside in the car while he selected another victim. After a few minutes, Ian reappeared in the company of 17-year-old Edward Evans, an apprentice engineer. Ian apparently introduced Myra as his sister, and he later claimed that he had picked Edward up for a sexual encounter. They drove back to the couple's home where they relaxed over a bottle of wine. And at some point, Ian sent Myra to get David, her brother-in-law. And as we know, throughout the previous year, Ian had been cultivating this friendship with him, something that increasingly worried Myra as she felt it compromised their safety. Myra returned with David and told him to wait outside for her signal, which we know is the flashing light. When the signal came, David knocked on the door and was met by Ian, who asked, "Are you here for the mini wine bottles?" and left him in the kitchen saying that he was going to get the wine. David later told the police, he quotes, "I waited about a minute or two, then suddenly I heard a hell of a scream. It sounded like a woman, really high pitched. The screams carried on and on after another and were really loud. Then I heard Myra shout, 'Dave, help him.' And when I ran in, I just stood inside the living room and saw a young boy. He was lying with his head and shoulders on the couch and his legs were on the floor. The boy was still screaming and Ian had a hatchet in his hand, holding it above his head and hit the boy on the left side of his head with it. I heard the blow. It sounded horrible." David then watched Ian basically strangle Edwards with the length of an electrical cord. Ian apparently sprained his ankle in the struggle, and Edwards' body was too heavy for David to carry on his own to the car, so they wrapped him in a plastic sheet and put him in the spare bedroom. David agreed to return the following morning with his baby stroller, which they used to transport Edwards' body to the car before disposing it on the moor. David arrived home around 3 a.m. and asked Maureen to make him a cup of tea, which he then drank before vomiting and telling her exactly what he witnessed. At 6:10 a.m. on October 7th, 1965, having waited for daylight and armed himself with a screwdriver and a bread knife, in case Ian was planning to intercept him, David called the police from a telephone box. He was picked up by police from that very box and was taken to the station where he told officers everything he witnessed the night before. Superintendent of Police Bob Talbot went to their street accompanied by another detective sergeant wearing bread delivery man's uniforms over their police uniforms, basically in disguise. They met Myra at the back door and asked if her husband was home. She denied that she even had a husband and that there was even a man in the house until Talbot identified himself. Myra led them into the living room where Ian was lying on the sofa writing to his employer about his ankle injury. Talbot explained that he was investigating an act of violence involving guns. Myra denied that there had been any violence at all and allowed police to look around the house. When police asked for the keys to the locked spare bedroom, she said it was at her workplace, but after the police offered to take her there to retrieve it, Ian finally told her just to hand it over. When police returned to the living room, they arrested Ian on suspicion of murder, and as he was getting dressed, Ian said, "Eddie and I had a row, and the situation got out of hand." Though Myra was not initially arrested, she demanded to go with Ian to the police station and wanted to take her dog Puppet. She refused to make any statement about Edward's death, beyond claiming that it was an accident. She was allowed to go home on the condition that she would return the next day. Over the next 4 days, Myra visited her employer and asked to be dismissed so that she would be eligible for unemployment. On one of these occasions, she found an envelope belonging to Ian, which she burned in an ashtray, claiming she did not even open it, but believed it contained plans for bank robberies. On October 11, 1965, she was arrested and taken into custody, being charged as an accessory to the murder of Edward Evans. Upon searching the couple's house again, police found an old exercise book with the name John Kilbride, which made them suspect that Ian and Myra had been involved in the disappearances of other young children. Ian told police that he and Edward fought, but insisted that he and David had murdered Edward together and that Myra had only done what she had been told. At one point, David said that Ian asked him to return anything incriminating, such as sketchy books, which Ian then packed into suitcases. He had no idea what else the suitcases contained or where they might be, even though he mentioned that Ian had a thing for train stations. A search of left luggage offices turned up the suitcases at Manchester Central on October 15th, and the claim tickets were later found in Myra's prayer book. Inside one of these suitcases was an assortment of costumes, notes, 9 pornographic photographs of Leslie Ann. She was naked with a scarf tied around her mouth, and a 16-minute audio recording of a girl identifying herself as Leslie Ann Weston, screaming, crying, and pleading to be allowed to return home to her mother. Leslie's mother later confirmed that the recording was of her daughter. Officers making rounds at neighboring houses spoke to Patricia Hodges, remember the 11-year-old? Who had on several occasions been taken to Saddleworth Moor, as we know, with the couple, and was able to point out their favorite sites. Police immediately began to search the area and on October 16th found the bone of an arm protruding from the ground. This arm was presumed at first to be John Kilbride's, but the next day was identified as that of Leslie Ann Downey. Her body was still visually identifiable and her mother recognized the clothing, which we know was buried at her feet. Also among the photographs in the suitcases were a number of scenes of the Moors. And on October 21st, 1965, they found the badly decomposed body of John Kilbride, which had to be identified solely by his clothing. That same day, already being held for the murder of Edward Evans, Ian and Myra appeared in court and were charged with Leslie's murder. They both were brought before the court separately and taken into custody for a week. They made a two-minute appearance on October 28, 1965, and were again taken into custody. The investigating officers continued to suspect the couple of murdering even more missing children and teenagers who had disappeared from the areas in and around Manchester over the previous few years, and the search for bodies continued after the discovery of John's body. Unfortunately, with winter settling, the search was called off in November 1965. Presented with the evidence of the tape recording, he admitted to taking the photographs of Leslie. However, he insisted that she was brought to his house by two men who had then taken her back and she was alive when they took her. By December 2nd, 1965, Ian had been charged with the murders of John Kilbride, Leslie Downey, and Edward Evans. Myra had also been charged with the murders of Leslie Downey and Edward Evans and as an accessory to the murder of John Kilbride, as well as a charge of harboring Ian and the knowledge that he had murdered. The committal hearing was held over an 11-day period during December 1965, at the end of which the pair were committed for trial. The 14-day trial began on April 19, 1966. The courtroom was fitted with security screens to protect Ian and Myra. The Attorney General led the prosecution, and Ian and Myra were defended by two experienced members of the Queen's Counsel. David Smith was the prosecution's main witness. And before the trial, the News of World newspaper offered £1,000 to David for the rights to his story, and the American People's magazine made a competing offer of £6,000. When David accepted the News of the World offer, its editors promised additional future payments for the reprint rights and publishing in regular installments. He agreed to be paid £15 weekly until the trial and £1,000 in a lump sum if Ian and Myra were convicted. Both Ian and Myra entered pleas of not guilty. Ian testified for over 8 hours and Myra for 6. Ian admitted to striking Edward Evans with an axe, but claimed that someone else had killed him, pointing to the pathologist's statement that his death had been accelerated by strangulation. Ian's calm, undisguised arrogance did not cause him to be loved by the jury, and neither did his excessive concern with minor details. Myra denied any knowledge of the photographs of Saddleworth Moor found by police that had been taken near the graves of all of the victims. The 16-minute tape recording of Leslie Downey, on which the voices of Ian and Myra were audible, played in open court. Myra admitted that her attitude towards Leslie was cruel, but claimed that that was only because she was afraid that someone might hear Leslie screaming. She also claimed that when Leslie was being undressed, she was downstairs. When the photographs were being taken of her, she was looking out the window, and that when Leslie was being strangled to death, she was running a bath. On May 6, 1966, after deliberating for a little over 2 hours, the jury found Ian guilty of all three murders, and Myra was found guilty of the murders of Leslie and Edward. As the death penalty for murder had been abolished while the couple were being held in custody, the judge passed the only sentence that the law would allow, life in prison. Ian was sentenced to 3 concurrent life sentences, and Myra was given 2, plus a concurrent 7-year term for the harboring of Ian and the knowledge that he had killed John Kilbride. Ian was taken to a men's prison where he asked to live in solitary confinement, and Myra Henley was sent to a women's prison. In his closing remarks, the judge described the murders as truly horrible and the accused as 2 sadistic killers of the utmost depravity. He recommended that they spend a very long time in prison before ever being considered for parole. He called Ian Brady wicked beyond belief and said he saw no reasonable possibility of reform for him, though he did not think the same was true for Myra once removed from Ian's influence. In her 3,000-word plea for parole in 1978 and 1979, Myra said, "Within months, he had convinced me that there was no God at all. He could have told me that the earth was flat, the moon was made of green cheese, and the sun rose in the west, and I would have believed him due to his power of persuasion." In 1985, Ian allegedly told a journalist that he had killed Patricia Reed and Keith Bennett, something the police had already suspected. So in November 1986, Keith Bennett's mother wrote to Myra, begging to know what had happened to her son. A letter that Myra seemed to be genuinely moved by, the letter ended with this: "I'm a simple woman. I work in the kitchens of Christie's Hospital. It has taken me 5 weeks' labor to write this letter because it is so important to me that it is understood by you for what it is, a plea for help. Please, Miss Henley, help me." Police visited Myra a few days after her receiving this letter, and although she refused to admit any involvement in the killings, she agreed to help by looking at photographs and maps to try identify spots that she had visited with Ian. She showed particular interest in photos of the area around Holland Brown Knoll and Shiny Brook, but said that it was impossible to be sure of the locations without visiting the moor. The courts agreed that a visit would be worth risking despite security problems presented by the threats against Myra. On December 16, 1986, Myra made the first of two visits to assist police search of the moor. Police closed all roads onto the moor, which were patrolled by over 200 officers. Myra left at 4:30 a.m., was flown to the moor by a helicopter, then driven and walked around the area until 3 p.m. She had difficulty connecting with what she saw in person to her memories and was allegedly nervous of the helicopters that were flying overhead. The press described the visit as a publicity stunt and mindless waste of money. On February 10th, 1987, Myra formally confessed to the involvement in all five murders, but this was not made public for more than a month. The tape recording of her statement was over 17 hours long. One of the officers described it as a very well worked out performance. I believe she told me just as much as she wanted me to know and no more. Police then visited Ian in prison and told him of Myra's confession, which at first he refused to believe. Once presented with some of the details that Myra had provided of Patricia Reed's abduction, Ian decided that he too was prepared to confess, but on one condition: that he immediately afterwards be given the means to commit suicide, a request with which it was impossible for the authorities to comply. Myra made her second visit to the moor in March of 1987. This time, the level of security surrounding her visit was considerably higher. Myra confirmed to the police that the two areas in which they were concentrating their search were correct, although she was unable to locate either of the graves. She later remembered that when Patricia Reed was being buried, she had been sitting next to her on a patch of grass and could see the rocks of Holland Brown Knoll silhouetted against the sky. In April 1987, news of Myra's confession had finally become public. Myra's lawyer persuaded her to release a public statement which touched on her reasons for denying her guilt previously, her religious experiences in prison, and the letter from Keith Bennett's mother. She also said that she saw no possibility of release and exonerated David Smith from any involvement in the murders other than Edward Evans. On July 1st, after more than 100 days of searching, Patricia Reed's body was found 3 feet below the surface, only 100 yards from where Leslie's body was found. Ian was taken to the moor on December 8th, 1987, and claimed to have located Bennett's burial site, but the body was never found. Even though Brady and Henley confessed to the murders of Patricia and Keith, the director of public prosecutions decided that nothing would be gained by a further trial, as both were already serving multiple life sentences and no further punishment could be inflicted. During the 1990s, Myra claimed that she took part in the killings only because Ian drugged her, was blackmailing her with pornographic pictures he had taken of her, and threatened to kill her sister. In 2008, Myra's legal practitioner, Andrew McCooey, reported that she told him this: "I ought to have been hanged. I deserved it. My crime was worse than Ian's because I enticed the children and they would have never entered the car without my role. I have always regarded myself as worse than Ian."
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. In 2017, the police asked that the courts order the two locked briefcases owned by Ian to be opened, arguing that they might contain clues to the location of Keith Bennett's body. The application was declined on the grounds that no prosecution was likely to result.
But why would you have these people and have so many unanswered questions? And this has been decades at this point, and you have unopened evidence.
Right. Unsolved murder. Well, technically not unsolved, but no body.
Right.
So let's round up the aftermath of all this. I know it's been a lot. Ian Brady spent 19 years in mainstream prisons before being diagnosed as a psychopath in November of 1985. Following this diagnosis, he was sent to the high-security Park Lane Hospital, now named Ashworth Hospital, and he made it clear that he never wanted to be released. Over the course of a few years, Ian went on hunger strikes and refused to eat. In 2012, Ian applied to be returned to prison, reiterating his desire to starve himself to death. At a mental health tribunal in June the following year, he claimed that he suffered not from paranoid schizophrenia, as his doctors maintained, but from a personality disorder. Ian's application was rejected, and he officially died on May 15th, 2017, from restrictive pulmonary disease. He lived to 2017, 5 years ago.
Trying so hard to kill yourself, and you still
can't. Failure.
Oh, God.
What a loser. Myra wrote to Ian in 1971 and ended their relationship. Myra was originally told that she should spend 25 years in prison before being eligible for parole. But in January 1985, the Home Secretary increased her eligibility to 30 years. In 1987, Myra admitted that the plea for parole she had submitted 8 years earlier was based on a pack of lies. In July of 1990, that same Home Secretary introduced whole life sentence for Myra, which was approved after her confession of being involved with more murders. She was not made aware of this decision until 1994. In 1996, the parole board recommended that Myra be moved to an open prison. She rejected the idea and in early 1998 was moved to a medium security prison. How are you just gonna reject and they listen to you?
She had to have been afraid to be in an open prison then.
Yeah.
Because she thought someone was gonna kill her ass.
Absolutely. I mean, she's a child killer.
Right.
Between December 1997 and March 2000, Myra made 3 separate appeals against her life sentence, claiming that she was a reformed Catholic woman and was no longer a danger to society. They were all rejected by the courts. On November 15th, 2002, at 60 years old, Myra died from bronchial pneumonia. Now, David Smith became highly criticized by the people of Manchester for financially profiting from the murders. During the trial, Maureen, who was 8 months pregnant at the time, was attacked in the elevator of the building in which they lived. After stabbing a man during a fight, David was sentenced to 3 years in prison in 1969. That same year, his children were taken into the care of local authorities, and Maureen was moved to a one-bedroom property and found work in a department store. On his release from prison, David moved in with a 15-year-old girl who became his second wife and won custody of his 3 sons. Maureen managed to repair the relationship with her mother and then divorced David in 1973, and she remarried and had a daughter. David Smith died from cancer in 2012. Patricia Reed's mother was admitted to a mental hospital in Manchester. She was present under heavy sedation at the funeral of her daughter on August 7, 1987. 5 years after their son was murdered, John Kilbride's parents divorced. Leslie Downey's mother died in 1999 from cancer of the liver. Since her daughter's death, she had campaigned to ensure that Myra remained in prison, and doctors said that the stress had contributed to the severity of her illness. And Keith Bennett's mother continued to visit Saddleworth Moor, trying to find her son's body until she died in August 2012.
I think it's cool that this is the first case that you've been able to follow up with the victims' families. I like that.
I know.
Especially because a lot of our cases are so old.
You never know.
You know?
And that just shows not only what their children have to go through, but what people have to live with after their loved ones are taken from them. And I know this case was very, very long, and it was a lot of information, but I feel like it was so important in how everything worked out. Obviously, compared to your case, their childhood wasn't as traumatic, but they still endured childhood trauma.
Right.
Which is
all our cases.
All our cases.
Every single
It's
one.
The main trigger, I want to call mm-hmm. it. In all of our cases.
That and being exposed to animal abuse, too. A lot of them are exposed to animal torture and, like, bestiality, which disturbs me on a whole nother level in itself. But no, just Keith Bennett's mom, you know, trying to find his body until she died. That's so devastating.
He's the only one of their victims that his body was never found.
That's just so upsetting.
And know? I'm going to
as we always do, post pictures of both cases, but the pictures I post from this case, I will actually show what Saddleworth Moor looks like. Yeah. So you can kind of see the land in which they were searching all these years.
All right, we know that was heavy and a lot, but that is all we have for this week's true crime episode. And not to sound weird, but we hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
This is always interesting to us. We have already kind of come up with a challenge for the next episode or two. So stay on the lookout for that. And if you know of any crazy killer couple that you want us to discuss, you can do one of two things. Send us a DM on Instagram or send us a voice message. And you know how they do that, Sam? They click the link in our Instagram bio, co.signpodcast. It's going to give you all the links to everything we're on. So go follow us on Instagram, again, co.signpodcast. Rate and review us on Apple because it's free to do so. And we will see you guys next week. Oh, bye. Oh my god. Oh my god.